Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Alchemy of Light broadcast. I am Jamil Graham, your host, and the Alchemy of Light broadcast is a celebration and exploration of consciousness, how we feel and think, because everything begins with a feeling. And today I'm very grateful to be welcoming a lovely person, a tremendous intelligence and a big heart that is bringing us not only a wealth of understanding in science, but the ability to explain these very large concepts in a way that is accessible to beginners like me. So thank you and welcome, Lee Bauman. Hello, Lee.
Hi, Jamil. Thank you so much for having me on your program.
It is such a pleasure. And you are, in your tagline, a quantum spirituality writer and author. You are also a trained doctor. You have done an extensive work in the geriatric, with geriatric care, including writing a book about how to go about hospice care in a conscious way. You've written several books in exploring the consciousness or the contribution of light in the exploration of God, of source creation. And one thing that I find very pleasing also in your story is that you started as a skeptic and then in your scientific exploration became a believer. And so I find the testimonies of people like you particularly rich in this exact thing of the scientific exploration and the scientific evolution and expansion of our consciousness step by step. So please, in your own words, share with us a little bit about your journey and a little bit about the books and the exploration of light. And then today we are going to be exploring your newest release, Medusa of Time, How Technology Redefines Copenhagen, which is a very interesting treatise. Go ahead, please.
Well, again, thank you, Jamil. Everything you said was right on target. So I appreciate the work you took into looking into my background. You are absolutely right. I started out as a religious skeptic at the time that I was practicing medicine back in the 1970s, and I was practicing geriatric medicine. I was resuscitating patients, and from that standpoint, I became interested in Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life, the first book on the near-death experience. At about the same time, I also became interested in Einstein's special theory of relativity. There were various aspects which I didn't understand and I wanted to pursue to a greater length because they actually seemed to imbibe spiritual qualities. So I began reading about special relativity, about Einstein's background and his history. For those of you who are familiar with his special theory of relativity and even the equivalence of matter and energy, light is really the keystone in both of those concepts that Einstein came up with. One of the basic concepts in his theories was that at the speed of light, time does not exist. Time basically stops for the photon. So I found that very fascinating. Then when Moody began writing about the near-death experience, again, I found it intriguing that one of the main concepts in the near-death experience was the entity of light, the being of light, who tended to represent God for the Jews, Allah for Muslims, and even Christ for Christians. For those who didn't believe in God, they often saw the light just as a guiding spirit. But again, the common theme in both quantum physics and in the near-death experience was the element of light. So I found that fascinating. I think sometime it was probably not until the 1980s, I actually began to research the world's religious texts, the sacred texts of almost every religion on this planet. And I think that was one of my eureka moments, as I would call it, where I was blown over by the fact that every religion described its deity in terms of light. And I think at that point I decided the connections with light were not serendipitous. I actually began to question whether there wasn't an intimate relationship between God and light. And that connection basically led to the publication of my first book, God at the Speed of Light, and it made me a believer, a spiritualist in God. So that, in a nutshell, was my journey, and I've been pinching myself ever since because it's been a very rewarding and wonderful journey. So I consider myself very fortunate.
And will you just take a little pause and define for us, being that you've come from a religious background, how your scientific expansion may have altered your understanding of religion versus spirituality?
Yes, I was raised as a Christian by basically a fundamentalist denomination within Christianity called the Congregationalists. And I certainly have really nothing against any religious denomination, but that happened to be the denomination I grew up with, and I was basically taught that the Bible, everything in the Bible was factual, was true, and I think anyone who researches any sacred text to any degree finds that there are a lot of inconsistencies and discrepancies and conflicts, which, you know, you really have to ask yourself whether this is all 100% factual. To myself, I reconcile the differences in that every sacred text was written through the hand of man or woman, and as such, we, our human nature, has us making mistakes, whether they're intentional or not. So that's how I view almost all of the world's sacred texts. They are wonderful books. I still get immense joy reading them, but I have to rationalize with myself that there are a lot of mistakes. And so I no longer accept any religious text as purely, you know, the word of God in every degree. So that is how I view religion. I think a lot of ministers and priests and, you know, the hierarchy of many religions tend to view it that way and teach the books in that manner to their followers, and it can lead to a lot of misinterpretation. I think that has a lot to do with the radical Islam terrorists that we see, and even within our own country, terrorists who, you know, have also been, like myself, not myself being a terrorist, of course, but raised as a Christian, and you know, the things have obviously gone awry, and they've become terrorists within our own faiths. So things happen, and I think we cannot rely as gospel the every word within our sacred text. Now, having become a believer, I basically believe that the God of all religions is the same God. So I think that basically comprises my own personal spirituality. My own personal spirituality basically has been derived from science and not from any one major religious text. So I consider myself non-denominational, but at the same time I feel I'm a very devout believer in God. I think it would be quite astounding if anyone could ever bend my faith in God at this point in time, because it's based in such what I believe to be very factual science. So that's how I view my own spirituality and how spirituality differs from religious views within our current time frame.
You give us an example of how that is to move from a personal point of view, but also I feel like you're giving us an idea of how the exploration of science can offer a grounded way out of this perpetual fear that seems to be gripping our world, which is one of the things that I find especially meaningful about taking on a study, even though it seems huge, you know, and it is really big to get these concepts, to have this understanding. Well, how can light be God? I mean, it's a long road of accumulating data, of sorting through your own beliefs. I think the hardest part isn't really the science so much. It's that at each sort of juncture of realization, what we face is our belief systems and the dissolving and the confrontation of the way we thought we knew things and opening to a new way of thinking, I think is perhaps even more challenging than the actual absorption of some of these concepts, you know, the scientific, the basic science itself.
Exactly. In fact, Jamil, when I was practicing medicine, I used to encounter quite frequently some patients who were either in my practice or if I was on call, who I would see in the emergency room, and these people had a history of being very devout believers. Yet, when they're there for the first time, laying in on that cot in the emergency room, and they are beginning to see their own mortality for that very first time, I have found that, at least it's my own belief, that having an extra layer of belief based upon science can really add a lot to your own belief in God. My own wife and many of my own relatives have always stated that they believed in God based upon faith alone, but I have found that, you know, in those trying times in the emergency room, it's nice to have that extra layer of security based upon science.
What an example that couldn't be more personal, you know, that moment we're all destined for, that place where
exactly.
We want to meet something, we're going to figure it out.
Exactly.
I want to share with the listeners at this point, too, that they can find out more information about you on your Google site. Would you please give your Google URL for people who'd like to learn more about you? We'll do this a couple of times in the show.
Oh, well, thank you for asking. It probably is actually easier just to do a Google search for Lee Bauman, and Bauman is spelled B-A-U-M-A-N-N. That's with two N's on the end. And one of the top three hits will be a Google site. For those who actually want the entire site, it's basically www.google.com/profiles/T. Lee Bauman, no spaces. And that will take you directly to the site. But for most people, it's probably easier just to Google Lee Bauman and go to the first Google site that you see.
Great. Thank you very much. And so in your journey, the exploration of light was basically the foundation of your scientific passion. And it has brought you to your new book, called Medusa of Time, How Technology Redefines Copenhagen. And you state very clearly in this book, as you did in the last book that I read as well, that you're one of your deep missions is to be able to make these concepts accessible. So I'm going to ask you to pull this book apart a little bit and really break it down for us, okay?
Yes, I would love to.
Okay, so let's start with what is Copenhagen? Please share with us where Copenhagen, what that theory is, what does it mean? What are we redefining here?
Oh, that's a great question. Copenhagen, as part of the title, stands for the Copenhagen Interpretation of Quantum Physics. And this is probably the major concept within quantum mechanics. What it basically states, at least at the current time, and the purpose of my book is to refine that definition, but currently most physicists accept the Copenhagen interpretation as stating that the nature of any object is a combination of both wave and particle. I think many of your listeners have heard about the wave-particle duality of everything. Sometimes light is observed in experiments and it's found to act as a particle, and the same for X-rays. Sometimes it's observed and appears to be acting as a wave, and again, the same for X-rays and a whole host of other quantum particles. It has never been fully understood why that would be the case. Now, the closest that the Copenhagen interpretation has come to in clarifying the wave-particle duality of nature is that there is something about the act of observation or of measurement that when something is measured, when something is observed, it becomes particulate, or it becomes a particle. Prior to being observed, it often exists as a wave. Now, that has actually been observed in a lot of light experiments, which I've written about in many of my books, and it is well known that when a photon is observed, it always is measured as a particle. And as a particle, it's always measured as traveling at 186,000 miles per second. So if we just take that observation, light as a particle is always observed at a finite speed, 186,000 miles per second. However, in experiments where light is found to behave as waves, it is often found not to pay any attention to time. And in several of my books, I repeatedly mention an experiment known as the quantum eraser experiment, which is a complicated name, but don't anybody get fearful of, you know, the complex nature of the name. But the experiment is fascinating because the experimenters did was that they altered the very end of the experiment. The experiment involved light waves, and the very end of the experiment was altered. Now, it does not take a rocket scientist to predict that if you alter the end of any experiment, and people who've taken chemistry classes know if you bungle an experiment at the end, it doesn't alter anything, you know, that you've already done at the beginning or the middle of the experiment. It just alters the end result. But with the quantum eraser experiment, which was just incredible to these researchers, by altering the very end of the experiment, actually altered the behavior of the light waves in the middle of the experiment. What I like to compare this action to is someone pouring water from one bucket that they're holding in their hands into a bucket on the floor, and someone comes along and they move the bucket, you know, 3 feet away from you, but you keep pouring. The analogy is that the water, without you moving, you know, makes a turn in midair, travels 3 feet, and continues its, transit into the bucket on the floor. It's that type of just incomprehensible result that should just not occur. And, of course, we have what I love are two of my most popular quotations is you have people like Richard Feynman stating that this type of behavior of light is impossible, and then you've got an equally talented scientist by the name of Niels Bohr who describes its behavior as shocking. So here you have two Nobel Prize winners who, you know, are probably or were two of the best quantum physicists of all time, and yet they were startled and surprised by, you know, up till the time of their deaths, were just couldn't find the behavior of light as being a comprehensible entity. So that was part of my spiritual revelation. At the same time, part of that nature can be at least partially explained through the observation that knowing that for the light wave that time does not exist means that it can theoretically exist everywhere at one time. And I'm talking literally about everywhere in the universe at one time. Obviously, at least from the context of my book, I propose that the reason for that is because it exists as a wave, and as a wave, it basically can be everywhere at one time. As a particle, its speed is restricted and reduced to the finite speed that we observe it at, being 186,000 miles per second. So I think it's the wave-particle duality of all things which is basically embodied within the Copenhagen interpretation. It does not offer any explanations other than the hypothesis as it currently exists is that observation or measurement is somehow involved. We have a mathematician by the name of John von Neumann, who hypothesized that the act of observation which caused the collapse of a wave to a particle was based upon human consciousness. I also used to believe that, and I still think, you know, it's a very rational conclusion, but the basis of my new book is that it really is not human consciousness, as cool an idea as I think that would be if that was the proven conclusion, but rather it's the element in the dimension of time in which we exist that causes waves to collapse to particles. So in a nutshell, that's an answer as to what exactly the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics states, is that all objects have both wave characteristics and particulate characteristics. I'm having trouble talking today.
And the Copenhagen theory is a suggestion that what creates one or the other, either the wave or the particle, is our conscious intervention with it, or our conscious engagement with it. And that is just one idea, but it doesn't have any conclusive theories about it. It's simply the theory that states the duality exists. Is that correct?
That's exactly right, Jamel. John von Neumann really was the one who deduced and hypothesized that it was human consciousness. But he only did that because he followed the chain of events in the collapse of waves to particles, and everything tended to be connected through some type of physical chain, and the only thing that was not physical happened to be the very end element of human consciousness, and his theory was that it was actually human consciousness that caused waves to become particles.
Well, perhaps this is a good segue to introduce quantum physics, because then the Copenhagen theory would be specific to quantum physics. Please explain what is quantum physics and how it connects to the science, what I call the material-based science body that has been dominant until the introduction of quantum physics, because what I heard you just say is a very important point about quantum reality, in that it embraces our experience of the things that we would traditionally classify as beyond our five senses. These are things that go into the dark matter. They go into the ethereal bands of our experience. And please share with us, well, what is quantum physics, and clarify that for us, and why we need that then in relation to the scientific body that's been amassed to this point.
I love that question, Jamil. Yes, quantum physics basically is defined as the physics of quantum particles. So we're talking about elementary particles involved within the atomic nuclei of atoms, as well as molecules to that extent. But if you basically look at the particles that are involved in the atomic structures that we all learned in grade school or high school, that is the physics that's involved. That physics appears to be totally different from the physics that many of us learned in high school and college, which was brought about through Sir Isaac Newton. You know, gravity, the effects of gravity, momentum, speed, friction, all those equations that we had to learn in high school and college to pass our physics courses, that was all physics of our macroscopic, or, you know, the world in which we live, the world that we observe on a day-to-day basis. We are unable to look into molecules and atoms and see how electrons and quarks and neutrons, protons, you know, how they are acting. We know that there are four major forces of the universe. There is the weak force of the atomic nucleus, the strong force of the atomic nucleus. There's something called the electromagnetic force, again, active mainly in the atomic nucleus. And then there's a fourth force, which basically has been ostracized, it appears, from the atomic nucleus, and that's gravity. And no one has been able to combine or merge the effects of gravity with the other three forces. When you hear physicists talk about the grand unified theory and, you know, the basic theory that will unite physics, they're talking about the fact that gravity has never been able to be brought in and merged with the effects of the other three atomic forces. So this is the physics of quantum physics. Sir Isaac Newton would have stood by the fact that a light particle or a photon traveling through the universe should, just like a sound wave, be measured at different speeds depending upon how fast we as the observer is traveling and in what direction the observer is traveling. We see the Doppler effect with sound because the sound waves actually become compressed as something making a noise approaches us, and they become rarefied as the sound-making device goes away from us. The compression and rarefication of those sound waves is actually because the waves speed up and they slow down. Sir Isaac Newton would have sworn by the fact that light waves should behave no differently. What Einstein proved was that light, no matter how fast we as the observer is traveling, no matter in what direction we as the observer is traveling, the light wave always travels at the same measured, and I emphasize the word measured, speed of 186,000 miles per second. What actually happens when we begin approaching light speed as the observer is not that light changes, but we as the observer changes. And what Einstein actually showed and has been proven subsequent to that is that as we approach light speed, our clocks as the observer begin to slow down. It is believed that if we could ever actually travel at the speed of light, that our clocks, just like the clocks of the photon, would stop. Similarly, our sizes shrink and our mass increases as the observer. Of course, none of this happens with the sound wave when we as the observer are measuring sound. The sound wave stays the same, or I'm sorry, the sound wave changes, it changes speed, and we as the observer stays the same. And what's so interesting is it's just the exact opposite with the light wave. The faster we travel, the more we change, and the light wave remains the same. That's one of the, you know, fascinations with the differences between quantum physics and the macroscopic world in which we live. Is it's really more like a fantasy world, although it's very real, and it's been proven to exist in the manner that scientists have measured the physics of quantum particles. But it's just so seemingly unnatural compared to the world in which we live. Did that help at all?
Well, that's really quite fascinating. In a way, that's skipping to the bottom line of your theory, that the requirement of measurement and time of some sort, the quantification, is what the light requires to be even assigned a light year component. Right?
Yes.
So you're
exactly
the measurement of a light wave, giving it an assigned measure, just pulling that out of the context of the macro world we live in, which is functional in the study of the macro world we live in, is itself part of the macro world. So then the study of quantum physics and the study of our place, well, maybe we could say it like this, our place in the universe, in the multiverse, in the cosmos, the place where the planet itself reaches into and joins everybody else, it becomes less functional. It needs to have this assignment of time and a reality with which to measure to have any particular purpose. Did I hear that right?
Yes. You know, with the current Copenhagen interpretation, physicists basically say they don't know why, when we measure a light particle, that it's traveling at a finite speed of 186,000 miles per second. And in some experiments where the behavior of light is seen to act as a wave, that time doesn't appear to exist. Hence, you change the end of an experiment and light's behavior changes in the middle. It's like time is stopped or even reversed, you know, for those photons within the experiment. So what the current Copenhagen interpretation is hypothesizing, with John von Neumann being its main proponent, is that it's the element of human consciousness. What my new book, Medusa of Time, is arguing is that it really isn't the act of observation or human consciousness, but it's when we perform these experiments that collapse waves to particles, we are actually capturing those waves within our dimension of time. The light wave exists outside of time, and that's why it can exist everywhere at once, you know, through the universe, as Einstein first theorized back in 1905 and has subsequently been proven. As soon as we observe that wave and we suddenly measure its speed as 186,000 miles per second, I would highlight the defining term per second, because we have basically captured that photon within our dimension of time in which we're trapped, and our entire existence is within the element of time. It really is hard for us as humans to comprehend what it must be like to exist outside of time. I believe the light wave exists outside of time. I believe God exists outside of time. And for many particles like X-rays and gamma rays and a lot of other particles, we as scientists have actually been able to energize even large molecules to the degree where we've been able to measure their behavior as waves. De Broglie, Louis de Broglie, first hypothesized back, when was the date of that? Back in 1924, that every particle, every object had an associated wave. And I discuss that in Medusa of Time, the fact that whenever macroscopic objects are trapped within our materialistic world, it's very hard for those large objects to escape that entrapment and become waves. But for small particles, for quantum particles, we are able to do that all the time, and we see it all the time in physics experiments using photons and light waves, that by capturing them within our dimension of time, that we're able to turn them into particles. So the premise of my new book is that it really is not human observation, but the dimension of time, which explains the wave-particle duality of nature.
Well, share with us, how do you define the dimension of time, and why is it that you perceive we're trapped there?
Well, that is a great question, Jamil. There are several definitions of time. I think the most common are those that we would read in any dictionary, where time is just a measurable period during which an action or process takes place. There's also a second, more interesting definition using the concept in physics known as entropy. Entropy is the concept that over time, our world becomes more disordered. And just by using time within the definition of entropy, some physicists have reversed that and are using entropy to define time. So I guess in a nutshell, what we are finding as human beings is that because we live in a material world, basically everything within our world that we see, feel, touch, hear, and smell and taste, we do so as particles. We do not experience any of our world as waves. Even when a light wave from the sun enters our atmosphere and goes into our eyes, at the point of the retina, those light waves become reduced particles, which then stimulate chemical reactions and nerve impulses, which allow us to, well, allow our minds to decipher that particle, and when we see a dot within the image, which is brought together with our brains. So I think every physicist would acknowledge that the world that we experience is a material particulate world. We do not experience really anything with waves. Even when we talk about sound waves and water waves, those are not waves in the sense of a photon or a light wave. Those waves are actually formed through compressed molecules. With sound waves, it's either compressed air molecules or, you know, air atoms, and with water waves, it's compressed water, which forms troughs and peaks, and we happen to call that a wave because it has a lot of characteristics of waves. But it really is not a true wave as what we would comprehend with electromagnetic radiation, which really is the main wave that physicists use to define waves, basically.
So is time a dimensional reality? Do you suppose that in the evolution of human consciousness, and this is where consciousness, you know, might have a play in this, because in your experience with near-death experiencers, there is a part of us that can experience things beyond our immediate physical experience. And so in your experience, your exploration of these things, these concepts, these journeys of people that are very real as well, would you consider that a doorway to expanding our evolution as a human experience? Or do you suppose that the human itself is only the material component of its reality, and that this other part of us that some people experience is just an anomaly? Or how does that fit in?
Well, that is one of the problems that physicists face, is trying to explain time. We've got a whole host of various physicists who argue that time is not real. And some names that I can throw out are, there's a British physicist by the name of Julian Barbour, and that's spelled B-A-R-B-O-U-R for anyone interested in looking him up. He basically hypothesizes that time is not real, that it is purely a something that we believe exists but doesn't really. He and a fellow physicist by the name of Bruno Bertotti actually published a paper where they go into all the intricacies of their hypothesis that time is not real, and that's really a fascinating subject, to see how he gets around the element of time. There's a author who's fairly well known by the name of J.M. McTaggart, that's McTaggart, and he actually wrote one book called The Unreality of Time, and another called The Nature of Existence, where he, much like Barbour, goes into his hypothesis that time is not real, that it's just a construct of our humanity. I think time could well be any one of four different possibilities. The first is that time is just purely an imaginary construct of our human mind, that it is not real. I don't really think that that's the case. That basically is what McTaggart would argue, and Barbour as well. Number two is that there are bubbles of time within our universe, and we just happen to exist within one of them. Outside of these bubbles, there is no time. That may actually, if that were to prove true, that may help explain some of the unexplained observations that we've made regarding dark matter and dark energy. The fact that we see some things that we can't explain because they actually exist outside of time, within a bubble, still within our universe, but it's outside of time. The third possibility is that there are multi-universes, of which, again, we happen to exist within one, which comprises the element of time as one of the characteristics of that multiverse. And then it just could well be that there's instead of a temporary bubble, which I mentioned just a few seconds ago, that there's a permanent part of the universe that exists both within time and outside of time. So there are two of the options: is that there is a temporary bubble within our universe, that there is a permanent bubble within our universe, that there are multiverses, and then just that time is really not real, and our minds, for some reason, are making up this characteristic that we call the dimension of time. So I basically break it down into four possibilities, any of which, one of which might be true. We haven't been able to narrow it down, but that's about as far as I've gotten regarding defining exactly what and how time exists within our universe.
Well, it's interesting because within time, our reality is constructed. You know, this radio program is 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern, and, you know, yes, the concept of time travel, which has gained a lot more exposure beyond sci-fi of late in the last years, you know, so the idea of a past, a present, and a future is a reality that we all live in to some degree, the way we put our stories together, or at least the way we communicate our stories. You know, we were there, we are here, we are going. It's like our whole language, reality is built on the time construct. So there must be something to it. Would you say that perhaps as an experience of human and the human evolution, the way that the human has evolved, that the integration of time could possibly be an option and not a dominant reality for all of us?
That is a tough question, Jamil. I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer that. I do believe that as humans, we have the capability of experiencing, you know, at certain times, and I hate to use that word in explaining this, but there are instances where I believe as humans we can experience what it must be like outside of time. One of those is what Raymond Moody discussed with his near-death experience interviews of people who survived. They often, when they were on the other side, did not really feel that they were experiencing time. They had all the answers to future events. They knew everything about the past. They knew what was going on in the present. And it was often very confusing for them. And I think we also find that during our dreams that we have very similar experiences, and that dreams can often be very confusing because I believe that the element of time becomes confused or perhaps does not exist at all within our dreams. We wake up and, you know, we may remember for a time what exactly the dream consisted of, but if we were asked to post all the events of the dream in chronological order, that often becomes very difficult. And I think one of the reasons is that the element of time is very confused or even absent within dreams. I think for the same reason clairvoyance and people who are able to predict the future, or even people who have the gift of mental telepathy, when they are communicating within this network outside of time, which comprises, I believe, basically the information and knowledge source of our combined universe, that they... I think I lost my train of thought. The person when they're within that realm of consciousness and knowledge, either in a clairvoyant state or dreams or someone who's able to predict the future, it's because that they are communicating with this network of knowledge which exists outside of time. So they're able to see into the future, into the past, and basically time does not exist. I believe that's how many clairvoyants are able to communicate with dead spirits and even spirits who are not yet born, because time just does not exist within that dimension.
Hmm. I'm curious. I don't want to get off track too much, but I would like to just sidestep a little bit into your work with religion. And I believe that book is called The Akashic Light, Religion's Common Thread. That's the book, right? And in your exploration of that, how did you find time in relation to the light of Source? Did you find it there?
Let me think. I mean, in that book, I basically decided to dissect all of the world's religions and how each different religion described its deity. The basic conclusion to that book, and basically the book is full of all the references relating to descriptions of each specific deity in terms of light, I basically believe that God exists outside of light, and that would that would basically explain the descriptions that we read about in every sacred text around the planet. You know, how God is basically omnipresent or everywhere in the universe, just like light. If you can imagine that if you were God and you could be everywhere in the universe at one time, that as a conscious entity, that you would also be omniscient or all-knowing. So that's another description that we typically relate to describe God. I like to describe God and light using what I call the three omnis, omniscience, omnipresence, and omnipotence, or being all-powerful, being the latter one. And there are actually some quantum physics concepts to support even the omnipotent one. We can, I think, appreciate the great and incredible energy of light by the fact that I'm speaking over a cell phone right now to you. And here I'm holding this tiny little thing in my hand, and yet these tiny little light waves or electromagnetic radiation called microwaves are traveling from this tiny device, you know, miles away to some cellular phone tower, and we're able to communicate. I mean, the power of these light waves is just incredible. We can look at when we're cold, which I travel so much, I find myself often in cold airports, and one of the first things I will do if I'm freezing is I will find a window someplace where the light's shining through. And it doesn't matter how cold, you know, the room is, I will get warm just basking within that sunlight. And again, here this light is traveling, what, 93 million miles from the sun, and it's able to warm, you know, my physical body from that distance. It is really just incredible. But there are actually more specific quantum concepts which have just baffled physicists, where they have tried to measure the energy strength of photons and found them to be infinite. If for those who might be interested, one term that they could Google is called renormalization. So that's R-E, the word normal, ization at the end. And the ultraviolet catastrophe, like ultraviolet light and catastrophe. These are two quantum physics observations where physicists found that they were measuring the energies of light and getting infinities. So it's all very fascinating, but that actually comprises the third omni of omnipotence of light, which, you know, we use the three omnis all the time to describe our concept of God. I find it fascinating.
That is fascinating. Thank you for that. I think it really relates, now looping back to, no pun intended, or maybe pun intended, time looping back to Medusa of Time. Let's go with light and describe light as the wave properties of light, and maybe we can do some basic science here. And all, what are some of the terms that are very commonly used in scientific bodies that describe light, or light waves, or light doesn't have a particle? Is that correct? Light is only a wave?
Well, light as a wave is its existence outside of time. Once we measure that light wave, or that light wave enters our retinas within our eyes, that wave becomes entrapped within our material world, within time, and it becomes a particle. So yes, light, just like every other object, is felt to exist both as waves and particles. As waves, these objects, or the energy, exists outside of time. Within the dimension of time, these objects exist as particles. So it's all, you know, it's, you're just talking fantastical notions, which are very difficult to comprehend. So what I like to tell my audiences is, when Niels Bohr made the comment that those people who are not shocked when they first hear about quantum physics, they could not have understood it. I love that quote, and I often tell my audiences, look, if you're confused and baffled, you actually are beginning to comprehend quantum physics more than the average person on the street, because they don't know enough to be confused, because that's the inherent nature of time and wave-particle dualities and all this stuff. But to answer your question about some of the characteristics of light, when we measure light, we're basically measuring it as a particle, because it becomes entrapped within our dimension of time. So the descriptions that you hear about light, for the most part, traveling, I think we often see the concept in physics books of light traveling like a sine wave, or like a roller coaster depiction of it going up and down in troughs and peaks like a water wave. That is the most common depiction of light, traveling as a particle in a sine wave configuration through troughs and peaks. So that is how we measure light. We find that it has various components. There's a we call light a form of electromagnetic energy because it has an electrical component and a magnetic component. And each of those travel in that trough and peak configuration. You know, when you begin talking about those type of characteristics, describing light becomes very confusing, and for good reason. It's a very confusing concept, so no one should be embarrassed if they are confused by it. The whole concept of light, and the fact that any object also has a wave, and from what we know about the light wave, is probably true for any wave of any object. The most we can conclude about waves and how they differ from particles is that waves are pure energy, so we're not talking particulate objects here. We're talking energy, and think of dark energy, because we really have no idea what dark energy is. And the bottom line is we really have no idea what light energy or electromagnetic energy is. Our basic concepts about waves are what we have seen after we've measured a wave. And so, you know, that's really a particulate result. As an analogy, most physicists now state that those models of the atom that we all learned in, what was it, grade school, junior high, and high school, where you have a central nucleus and electrons were tiny particles rotating around that central nucleus. Most physicists now say, you know, you should forget that, because the reality is that these particles probably exist as undefinable waves, and we really don't know what we're talking about, you know, because we don't know what a wave is. So we know that an atom and molecules are basically energy. We've used the models of electrons orbiting around a central nucleus only to help us better understand the concept of an atom and how it works in chemistry and biology and whatnot. But we really don't know about its wave qualities. The most that we know about waves is that if a wave is emitted from a source, that the farther away that the wave travels from that source, the weaker its energy field becomes. And that makes sense because it is actually spreading out almost, you know, by the time it reaches the other side of the universe, it's spread out to almost an infinite degree. And so that wave, if you happen to measure it at some point on the other side of the universe, its electric charge is going to be much weaker than if you had measured it very close to the source where it was emitted. And similarly, the farther away it gets from the source, the greater its wave band, its wave front. If you can imagine, I'm trying to think, most of us, when we see a radio tower illustrated on TV or in books, it shows these curved lines emitting or emanating from the tower. And the farther away that those waves get from the tower, those curved lines basically become infinitely great. They become infinitely big. So we know that the greater the distance of a electromagnetic wave from its source, the bigger it is, but the weaker it is. And really, except for those two characteristics, we really know very little about waves. So I probably haven't helped you much in that description.
Well, I think you have, because I think one of the things that we are doing with the independent scientists like yourself and other, you know, so many people, thanks to our access to information via the internet and also the intelligence of people and the ease of making books and putting thoughts together. You know, we have a huge wealth of independent scientists, independent thought, independent explorations that are very helpful. And one of the things that I really resonate with in so many of the independent thinkers that, you know, is that whenever we begin exploring big questions, we find bigger questions. And to me, the exploration of science isn't complete if you haven't found the next question. To me, the answer is the next question, you know? So I'm very easy with that. It's just a whole new paradigm, you know, to kind of get your mind in, because from the material base, you know, the macro exploration, the science that's quantified and measured by our physical experience that we presume we can measure, and I think, you know, presume is an important word to add in that, because as we become more curious, you know, who knows? Maybe there are little messages on our baby finger that we haven't yet perceived because we are just, you know, at a level of consciousness that allows that. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think that is such a great analogy because, you know, what teachers can identify with this, and that is they're up before a class, they think they know the subject cold, and they begin, you know, lecturing or discussing the topic of the day. Students then begin to ask questions, and suddenly the teacher finds that he or she doesn't have all the answers that he or she thought they had. So, yes, I think it's just wonderful that the, you know, the more questions we ask, the more we find we don't know, and we just keep on looking. So it's that's how we learn, and I think it's great.
Yeah, me too, and it's much more interesting, and it's certainly a lot more friendly to our kids who are free spirits and thinkers, you know. I mean, as a kid that seemed to be born with her hand up, asking questions when you go to a class or a academic environment where they presume to know all the answers is not really welcome, you know.
Right.
In that rigid stretch.
Yeah, it's so nice to have a teacher who invites questions, you know, and who makes the student feel comfortable asking questions, because it's the old cliche that through questions it helps not only the student but the teacher as well.
Yeah, and the theories, something you refer to in your book, Occam's Razor, I feel that's really valid, because the things that are really consistent and the easiest to understand are steady. You keep finding them over and over again. You might find them in a different expression, but they're the same. So you don't really, it's fun.
Scientists love Occam's Razor. And I don't know, some of your listeners might be wondering how that's spelled, and I'm even struggling, but because it's a strange spelling. I believe it's like either O-C-H or O-C-K, and then H-A-M. There are a number of different spellings. But he was a philosopher who stated that the more simply you could define or explain something, the more likely it would be true. And there's probably no better example of that than Einstein's formula E equals MC squared. You know, he's taken his entire basis for the equality of energy and matter and brought it down to, you know, those four digits. And it's nothing short of miraculous how you know, someone could do that, and that's one of the bases for why Einstein is judged to have been such a genius. It's just amazing, and then that's a perfect example. Here you've got E equals MC squared, and it explains an entire theory that normally took, you know, pages and pages of science articles to explain. So that's a great example.
I found Occam's in my notes. It's in your spelling in your book. It's O-C-C-A-M apostrophe S. And will you explain to us the E equals MC squared? Please just take that apart and define that for us, because we hear it, you know, E equals MC squared, but what does it really mean? What is E? What is MC? Who's squared?
Certainly. Basically, Einstein's equation of E equals MC squared, he defines E as being energy. So that's really any form of energy that for us humans we would typically identify as being electromagnetic radiation, at least within our existence.
Is that seen and unseen as both?
I'm sorry?
Electromagnetic energy, both seen and unseen.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, you're talking about energy which I think for the most part, I would visualize as being outside of time and hence the wave part of the wave-particle duality, but we really don't know enough for me to narrow it down to that.
Okay.
We're basically just talking electromagnetic energy. Physicists define all forms of light and all forms of electromagnetic energy as light. They call them photons. So a gamma ray is called by a physicist a photon. X-rays, microwave radiation, which I'm using to talk with you right now through my cell phone, radio waves, TV waves, even ultraviolet radiation that causes sunburn, these are all forms of electromagnetic energy. So that basically is the E of E equals MC squared. Matter basically comprises all the materialistic components that we basically surround ourselves with. We are part of that M, or matter, or mass. The table, I have my notes on, you know, part of mass. The C represents the speed of light, and Einstein felt that the factor that linked matter to energy was the speed of light squared. So if you take the mass of an object and you want to determine what its energy would be if it were actually converted over to pure energy. Now, the classic example, of course, is the atomic bomb.
Mm.
Using uranium, when it reaches a critical mass, that matter becomes converted to energy, and hence you've got the tremendous explosion inherent with the atomic bomb. Mm. So converting matter to energy creates a vast amount of energy, light, the speed of light squared, which, you know, that's a lot of zeros.
Mm.
So that is in basic form how to interpret his E equals MC squared. Energy, for the most part, like I mentioned, I visualize as being energy outside of time because we're really discussing energy in its purest wave form.
Okay.
So that's how I see it.
Okay, thank you. And then go from there. In your book, you actually start with that E equals MC squared and the relationship with Einstein's tree. Explain how E equals MC squared defines a tree and how that relates to the measure of time.
Oh, lovely question. I love this story. Ernest Sternglass was a physicist who had the opportunity to interview Albert Einstein. And they were sitting outside at a table and they were talking, and Einstein was telling him about how much he disliked one of the main tenets of quantum mechanics, which, by the way, he and Niels Bohr actually helped to comprise. But what he found was that through, you know, all of the experimental research was that this major tenet of quantum mechanics called the Copenhagen interpretation was suggesting that observation, perhaps, you know, human consciousness, was the catalyst for materializing energy into its particulate nature. And the example he used was he turned away from Ernest Sternglass. He said, now, take, for example, that tree over there. And Dr. Sternglass turned and looked at the tree, and, yeah, I see the tree. And Einstein said, now, turn your head away. Is the tree still there? And what Einstein was suggesting was, again, this main tenet of the Copenhagen interpretation, which suggests that if you're not observing that tree, if you're not looking at that tree, if you're not somehow measuring the substance of that tree, that it doesn't exist. And that basically is what the current concept of the Copenhagen interpretation is stating. We have all, well, maybe not all of us, but probably a large number of us have been asked the question in school that if a tree falls in the forest, does it make a sound? Now, I think for myself and probably for a lot of your listeners, we didn't really care. You know, if a tree fell and no one was around, we concluded that it probably did make a sound, but maybe the teacher was getting at the fact that if no one could hear it, that, you know, that was somehow what he was talking about. Mm. Well, I never understood it until I read about Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics, and it all became clear in that quantum physics states that for that tree to make a sound, human consciousness or some form of observation or measurement has to exist. If the sound, the compressed air molecules do not enter, you know, our ears and cause the sound to be comprehended within our brain substance, that quantum physics is stating that that tree did not make a sound. I think that's one of the stimulus, or one of the stimuli for my writing Medusa of Time, is it, to me it just seems so more natural that the Copenhagen interpretation explains the collapse of waves to particles not due to our human consciousness, but due to waves becoming entrapped within the materialistic framework of our existence, which the catalyst for that is the element of time. So that's how I tend to like to explain the concept of Einstein's tree, as I call it.
Uh-huh. So that was a cornerstone in the whole philosophy right there. That was where that came from. That's great. I didn't know that.
It can be very confusing.
Yeah, but it's kind of one of those things. Some people, I think, have minds that can get their head around it. I think other people have minds that get their heads around intuitively concepts of it. And
well, you know, I like to tell my audiences when I'm talking that I began reading about this stuff back in the mid-1970s, and I published my first book, which detailed the conclusions I made about quantum physics and near-death and whatnot, and that was like 2001. So it, you know, it only took me 25 years to comprehend what was going on. So people shouldn't become concerned or feel that they're dim-witted or anything if they don't understand these concepts, because it has baffled the best minds here on this planet, including Nobel Prize winners. And like I say, it took me 25 years to comprehend just some of the basic tenets of quantum mechanics. So I still have a lot to learn.
Hmm. God bless your heart. Will you share with us a bit about some of the experiments that were done? Because you do a good job of exploring why the idea of Copenhagen needs to be redefined or by these quantum physics experiments. And perhaps we could start with the last one that you explored. I'm very fascinated by this, that kind of goes back one from there, the EPR experiment, where a common source emits two photons and they have the same exact experience. And explain the terminology a little bit, too, in that would make the book more accessible, the entanglement and these kinds of words.
This experiment just fascinates me because it's again, very, very convoluted, but at the same time, it can be a very simple explanation can be used to explain it. what when Einstein didn't like about his tree, and we've discussed the element of observation or measurement, he and two other people got together and formulated what is known as the EPR experiment. Now, EPR stands for, the E stands for Einstein, the P stands for one of his colleagues with the last name of Podolsky, and R stands for another colleague by the name of Rosen. So hence the EPR experiment. It's a very classic and renowned experiment within the physics world. What Einstein and his colleagues thought of was they knew that there were instances where atomic particles would liberate photons or light waves going out in opposite directions. Now, he knew that quantum physics basically stated that any wave or particle that emanates from a common source is forever linked together, just like twins. And he called this linking, he called it entanglement. So entanglement is the physics word for the linking of, whether you want to call them quantum particles or quantum waves, they are linked, and it doesn't matter how far apart they travel from one another, they are still linked, irregardless of the space between them. And then that's one of the impossible corollaries that Einstein just could not accept. He and his colleagues felt that when two particles became separated by some finite distance, that they became independent of one another. The quantum, the Copenhagen interpretation stated no, they were forever linked. And that was another tenet of quantum physics that he and his two colleagues just hated. So they formulated this experiment thinking that someday this experiment might be carried out, and they didn't know if it would be carried out in their lifetimes or not. The first proof of the experiment was not done in the science lab. It was actually done by a mathematician by the name of John Bell, and it's called Bell's theorem. Again, it's very complicated and complex, and I wouldn't even attempt to explain it in this short period of time, but most mathematicians and scientists and physicists accept his proof as proving that indeed two particles liberated from a common source, irregardless of the space between them, are forever linked. And so that was the first proof. The second and third proofs of the experiment came about by two other scientists who actually conducted the experiments in the laboratory. And when I say proofs, I might be confusing your audience, because what these people proved was not that Einstein was right, but that the Copenhagen interpretation was right. So they actually proved that Einstein and his two colleagues were wrong. So that was very, very key to the experiment. Now, one of the scientists, I think probably the best known, who carried out the laboratory experiment went by the name of Aspect, was his last name. And what he found was just fascinating, and actually Bell mathematically proved this, if you can believe it. It is really amazing what math can do. What they found in their proofs was not only do these two particles remain linked throughout space and time, irregardless of the of the distance between them, but just like an observer who is trying to measure the speed of a light wave, where he finds that the speed of the light wave remains the same, and instead it's the observer who changes. The fact that his clock slows down, his spatial dimensions shrink, and his mass increases the faster he goes. That they found a very interesting corollary, very similar, or perhaps not similar, but there are some similarities in that if when they're measuring these two particles separated space and time that have been emitted from this common source, if the person measuring one of the particles turns his measuring device, it actually alters the result of the person at the other end of the laboratory, or you could go on to say at the other end of the universe. It alters his results when he measures his particle on the other side. It doesn't make any sense. You know, these things should not happen. By changing the measuring process should not alter the observer or the measurement, but it does. Again, just one of the many mysteries of quantum physics that we have to contend with, but fascinating.
What do you mean when you say linked? Does that mean they behave the same, or when you say one alters the other, what you do to one then happens to the other two, or what does linked exactly mean?
Well, I like the term linked because I'm not convinced of all the ramifications of some of the observations that are made in these experiments. Now, in the experiment that I depict commonly in my books, which are performed by Aspect, his name is Alain Aspect, was that he actually found that if photons were involved, that if he was measuring light waves that were emitted from a common source, that the light waves were actually identical. Now, other experiments that have actually measured larger waves, or, you know, basically when we measure these waves, we're measuring them as particles, they find characteristics which are similar that they call spin, and again there are other qualifying degrees to describe characteristics of particles and waves. So I'm honestly, when you get to the point where you're explaining all of the characteristics of these particles and waves, I personally don't feel comfortable in stating that they're identical, but many of the experiments suggest that these particles are basically identical in at least many of their characteristics. I still have a lot of questions in calling them identical, but we do know that, I like to use the word linked, that there are at least some characteristics that when you measure one particle, the characteristic is identical on the other side. Whether all of these characteristics, you know, of the waves and particles, whether all of them are the same, I have my doubts. But there are certainly enough similarities to convince me that there is a union of some type, you know, connecting these two forms of energy or these two particles. But it's like everything else in quantum physics. We still haven't ironed all the intricacies out yet.
So you would you feel comfortable then saying that there are enough identical phenomena in one to recognize the other in it?
Yes.
Right? Yes.
Okay. And a lot of physicists like to expand the concept of this linkage in that Sir Isaac Newton used to say in his macroscopic physics world that for every action there is an equal but opposite reaction. And there's a similarity which It's not the same, but there's a similarity in that for every action, and this is what the EPR experiment results suggest, for every action here that we observe, you know, on planet Earth, there's another action taking place. We just don't know where it is. It might be on the opposite side of the universe because of this entanglement of particles and waves. It might be, you know, across the street at our neighbor's house. We just don't know. But hence we get the descriptions and terms like the butterfly effect. The example that when a butterfly flaps its wings, that it is actually altering things going on perhaps on the other side of the universe. We don't know what these things are, but that's basically what the EPR experiment and this entanglement theory is getting at, that for every action, there's equal, well, maybe not even equal, but there's a reaction someplace else.
That is interesting. And this is, you know, one of the bridges that we can find for spirituality to science as well. And just in the vision, as you're saying that, the infinity sign comes to mind. You know that?
Yes. Yes. Which, in fact, I like to make the analogy, which I allude to in several of my other books, that it has been proven that our brain waves actually emit electromagnetic radiation. And when these are measured, and it takes very sophisticated instrumentation to be able to measure these waves, but when we measure them without the use of electrodes, such as with an EEG or an electroencephalogram, which is the machine that doctors use to diagnose epilepsy, you see all these squiggles on a piece of paper, and those are called brain waves, but they're measured using electrodes where wires are attached, you know, to someone's head. These brain waves, which have been measured that I'm talking about now through electromagnetic energy, do not require electrodes, wires, to be measured. They are very weak brain waves, but they are still a proven form of electromagnetic energy, which have been measured in research, you know, medical research institutions that our brains emit. So again, very much analogous to the cell phone emitting radio waves, these waves can really, we have no idea how far out into outer space they're traveling, and they could explain all sorts of paranormal events like mental telepathy, clairvoyance, I mean, you name it. And the bounds by which these waves can travel have no limits. And again, it boils down to the fact that a wave can basically be everywhere in the universe at one time when it exists as a wave. So it's all very intriguing.
It's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. You know, we're just eventually going to move ourselves right into some sort of timeless reality just because it's so interesting.
Oh, it is. It absolutely is. It's so fascinating to me that I'm surprised that there aren't more books on the subject and more discussions about it, because most of everything we've talked about here on the show, in fact, I think everything that we've talked about has some basis with proven experiments in the realm of science. So, you know, you have to consider that something real is going on here.
And that's why I find such value in your work, because there is something real going on here, and that is our opportunity, our privilege, our great gift to jump in and check it out, you know? And I think I'm curious how, actually, I have one more question about the EPR, do you know in this experience or in how they decide what their common source will be? You mentioned that it's a neutral pion or calcium or mercury atom. you mentioned a few other things and other experiments, but I wonder, do you know what it is that determines the source they're going to choose?
Perfect question, Jamil, because so many of the experiments, the early experiments, were based upon, you know, the atoms that I list in the book. And what fascinates me now is if you go on the internet, you can read about, I mean, on a daily basis, they're finding that larger and larger particles, you know, we're talking huge molecules, really. Not only do they have waves which can be measured, of course, as soon as they're measured, they, you know, they're measured as particles, but their behavior can be recorded as existing at some point in the experiment as waves. That the energy is, you know, not only is it everywhere, but I'm getting sidetracked. But there is a concept known as proton decay, and this particular concept suggests that at the end of all time, when the universe basically decomposes and degrades, which it's felt it will do, and it's going to be in billions and billions and billions and billions of years from now, that our entire universe at the end of all time will exist as photons or as light energy. So, you know, so much of this is just so fascinating. The science behind it really has to make you believe that there is a higher power. Now, I think I may have gotten sidetracked, and I can't even remember what your original question was, do you?
Well, that's okay. I kind of like that little sidetrack. I was just curious how they determined what their atom source would be and, you know, creating these experiments. I'm starting to notice in my studies different, you know, consistencies and patterns, and so I was just curious if you knew how they choose certain materials.
Well, yes, thank you for refreshing my mind here, because what I was building up to was not only are they measuring waves with bigger and larger particles, and eventually, you know, we're going to be measuring waves of automobiles and buildings and whatnot, but what we're finding is that we're able to find entangled particles being liberated from all sorts of common sources. So we're talking about electrons that are emitted from a common atom or even perhaps a common molecule, light waves which are emitted from a common source. And I'm trying to recall, I think there are actually several experiments where they have measured that atoms which have, you know, been liberated from common sources are even linked. So the entanglement of our materialistic world, we're finding, really is expanding at an exponential rate. And I think at some point in time, with enough technology and sophistication, we are going to find that everything is entangled. And that's going to be a fascinating time when that happens.
Yeah, and I think we're right on that crest now. We're at a place now where we can be held back no longer. This is my feeling, and this is what a big part of my passion in bringing people like you on, and the many scientists that are breaking through this, because there's some part of us that's just really ready to move forward now, and we certainly will. You know,
yes.
This is very exciting.
Science is just moving so fast that, you know, every day we read in the newspaper about new advances in technology and science and astronomy and all these probes that we're sending up into outer space. You know, the more we learn about this universe, it it really is incredible. And I think it's going to add to our spirituality rather than detract from it. So it's I read each of those articles with interest.
I share that. And it just seems to be a really common denominator with physicists and people that are dedicated to science, that they come to that reality that the universe is a magnificent place and inspires awe, you know? It's in the math, folks. It's in the math.
Yes, exactly. I mean, Einstein's E equals MC squared suggests that, you know, we're all related. Mass is just a transmutation of energy, and I think the entire universe is entangled, and at the end of time, you know, we're all going to be together. It'll be the ultimate oneness with the Creator in the form of light, I personally believe. But, yes, it's just a fascinating topic.
Our great homecoming.
Yes.
Well, we have zoomed by. We'll have 10 minutes left in this interview. We've been speaking with Dr. T. Lee Bauman, and to find out more information about him, the easiest way is to simply Google Lee Bauman, spelled B-A-U-M-A-N-N, and you will see several listings come up, and click on the first Google profile that comes up. You will find more information about him. He has written several books exploring consciousness and light and God and the relationship of light and God and consciousness and science and quantum science. And something else that I feel really important to mention about you and your work is that you have developed a scholarship program. You have built into your business model philanthropy, the importance of giving back to the community, and I have a lot of appreciation for this. Would you please, in our remaining time, tell us about your scholarship program? I think this is really, really special and part of the new wave of connecting, you know, in the future.
Thank you so much for bringing that up, because it's something I believe so heartily in, and that's H-E-A-R-T, heartily, that I have always been a big proponent of education, and I use every dime that I get from proceeds and royalties from all of my books to go into any one of a number of God at the Speed of Light college scholarships. Now, most of them exist within the states of Alabama and Mississippi, because I really wanted to target, I thought, the most needy states within the United States, and I thought Alabama and Mississippi were two great targets. I just recently established a God at the Speed of Light endowment also in Cape Town, South Africa, where I recently volunteered, and I was just so impressed with the South African people. There is so much poverty there, and yet they have survived apartheid, and they remain so proud. One story I love to tell about the South African people is that when I was undergoing an orientation there, I was told that whenever you saw a South African on the streets of Cape Town, you had to say hello. And I said, no, you've got to be kidding. You know, you just don't do this in America. And I was emphatically told, no, you have to do that. It's considered rude if you don't. And so I did it, and lo and behold, everyone responded so kindly and energetically with a hello. The only ones who didn't were the other tourists. So, I love being able to help inspire education at the many colleges throughout Alabama and Mississippi and now South Africa. Right now, I think I've got about 30-some scholarships to help financially needy students at those colleges. So I'm very proud of that, and I hope to be able to do more.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much. And would you like to offer a very brief closing comment, and then I'll wrap us up?
Well, let's see. I'm trying to think what might be a good way to end this. I think probably the most important thing I could say is that science has so much to offer the spiritual person. And even the spiritual person who states that they believe in God based only upon faith alone. I have seen so many times when that faith becomes a little bit lacking when that person is looking their creator into the eye for the first time in that emergency room, having been a practicing physician. And I think science lends itself to be a foundation to our human spirituality. So I would really encourage people to read up on science. I'm a big believer in the sciences, obviously, through the scholarships. And I just think science offers a great foundation for spirituality to act as a not only a building block, but as something to fall back on if all those passages within our sacred texts, come up short as they often do. So I love science, and I feel it has so much to offer. So I think those would probably be the most fitting words I could end on.
Great. Well, thank you very much. We have been talking to Lee Bauman, once again, spelled B-A-U-M-A-N-N, and you can Google him and check out his profile. And thank you so much, Lee, for taking this time and for sharing with us all this really great and interesting information. I really appreciate it, and thank you.
Well, Jamel, it has been a privilege and an honor, as it always is when I get to be on your program. So I wish to thank you again for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Likewise. And so you've been listening to the Alchemy of Light broadcast, and I want to take this minute also to thank the good people in the back of the house at the BBS radio, and thank all the great spirits that have joined us that are making this all possible with all their love and support, all the ancestors that have gone before us, walking the path of light that brought us all here today. Thank you to all the listeners for joining us. I hope you found some good food for thought, good food for soul. And I am Jamil Graham. You are listening to the Alchemy of Light broadcast. You can check out my blog, alchemyoflight.org, for information about upcoming shows and an exopolitical exploration of life at that. Okay, we are signing off here for this broadcast. So, and we'll be back in a fortnight. Take good care of yourselves and take good care of each other until then. Bye-bye.